Hey guys, before we get started, this podcast has some strong language. You've been warned.
Oh, hello. This week's episode of The Rabble was recorded at 4:11 p.m. on Thursday, April 11th, 2019 in the great state of Texas, where the official state reptile is the Texas horned lizard, otherwise known as the horny toad.
Wait, is it a toad or a lizard?
No one's going to make a joke
about
that. I
have a lot
of questions.
Welcome to The Rabble, a podcast by Rouser. We are three progressive Texans who felt like flipping some tables after the 2016 election, but we decided a more productive use of our energy would be to flip congressional seats instead. So for the last couple of years, we've been learning to become activists, eventually quitting our corporate jobs to form our new venture, Rouser. Our goal is to inspire other progressive Texans to get some shit done, and to share the stories of the candidates, electeds, and organizers who inspire us to do shit. Consider us your humble, uncivil servants.
Every week, we will have three distinct segments. First up is always political fuck, marry, kill. Now, you guys know we're not fucking, marrying, or killing politicians, but rather political stuff that's happening this week. This isn't even political. Shit. For example, I want to fuck the hole in the sky that was captured for the first time ever by a graduate student at MIT's algorithm, Katie Bauman. Way to go, Katie
Bauman.
You're amazing.
And because the more you know, Becky will be doing our Did Y'all Know segment for the week. And this week we have a fucking awesome guest, Jody Casey, who was the campaign manager for Beto's 2018 Senate race.
Oh, so excited to talk.
Amazing. It's great. And then we'll finish out with some shit to do from Ashley, because this state legislature ain't gonna flip itself, y'all.
We're your hosts. I'm Kristen Gunn.
I'm Ashley Chang. I'm Becky Bullard. Together, we're Rouser, and this is The Rabble. Today's episode of The Rabble is brought to you by the Austin Young Dems. Join them at their annual membership drive Thursday, April 18th at Cheer Up Charlie's. Their membership is $10 a year.
Whoa.
Such a bargain. But for this meeting, and this meeting only, you can join the Austin Young Dems for just $7.
What? You can, like, buy a beer with the savings.
Yeah, about $3. Yeah.
You can buy me a beer with the savings.
And you can, yes. So the Austin Young Dems is open to those between ages of 14 to 40. I say this because I always wonder when I hear young things.
Like, what is young?
Things. Yeah, like, do I count? But they also offer a Young at Heart membership, so really all are welcome.
Oh, I love that.
So inclusive.
Plus, they'll have some very, very special guests in attendance doing a live show.
Wait,
dun,
who?
Dun, 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 dun.
The Rabble!
The Rabble!
Oh my God, they can buy us beers.
Yes. So come join us. It's going to be a good time. We'll link all the info in the show notes.
All right, guys. First up, political fuck, marry, kill. Becky, you've got the fuck this week. What's going on?
I do. And it's sort of a complicated fuck that I feel a little weird about.
So like a college fuck?
Totally, totally. This is like a 20s fuck. So House Bill 357, which in the media and the advocates for it, they are calling it a constitutional carry bill.
Okay.
Blah.
Hold up. Mm-hmm. Why do we call it this? Can we just call it what it is, which is
yes,
like an irresponsible, unnecessary, licenseless open carry bill?
Oh, yes. That's a lot of words. But no, that is far more accurate than the words constitutional carry. So if you don't know what constitutional carry means, or permitless carry, as folks on our side of this issue would call it.
Or people who just like to describe things for what they are.
Accurately. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So gun extremists call it constitutional carry because they believe that the Second Amendment means that anybody can carry a gun at any time for any reason, and they don't need to have any training or any permits or any restrictions around it whatsoever, which is simply not true. The Supreme Court has said that that's not a thing, that the Second Amendment does not guarantee that anybody can carry a gun at any time without training or permits. And so constitutional carry is really the wrong thing to be calling this. But they call it that because the GOP extremists are pretty good at messaging things.
And then the media picks up on it. But yeah. Not this media, not The Rabble.
No. We're
smarter than that.
See right through it. Try to be.
I don't need your freedom fries or your constitutional punches in the face. No, thank you.
So the fuck part of this is this House Bill 357 for permitless carry is dead. It's not going anywhere. It's not going to pass. But there is some really interesting context and background and drama to what is going on with this bill.
Let me get my popcorn. Hang on.
Yeah, tell us more. So a lot of this information came to me. I had a great conversation with Ed Scruggs. He is the vice chair of Texas Gun Sense, which is a nonprofit founded and funded in Texas to advocate for common sense policies around guns. And he's very knowledgeable. He's been working on this issue for a long time, and he was able to provide me with a lot of the backstory as to how we got where we are today with this drama. So you guys remember the tragedy at Sandy Hook, right?
Yeah.
The school is really terrible. And how a lot of states responded to that was to make more laws that would make gun ownership safe and responsible so that tragedies like that wouldn't keep happening. Texas, though, said, we're going to go the other way and loosen our gun laws instead of tighten them. So it was after that tragedy that Texas enacted campus carry, allowing people to carry guns on university campuses. And it passed with 7 minutes left in the legislative session, last session, as well as open carry. We cut training requirements. We cut fees for licensing. And the only thing that these gun extremists didn't get was permitless carry. So that's their Shangri-La that they are fighting for. And so House Bill 357, the permitless carry bill that was filed this session by none other than Rep. Jonathan Stickland, who we mentioned last week on the panel.
Gotta stick it to Stickland.
He's full of bad ideas.
Get him
this
out.
Guy. So he filed the bill this time, but it wasn't going anywhere fast enough for these extremists. And what you will learn if you pay attention to the Texas legislature for a while is that if a bill doesn't get a hearing pretty early on in the session, because our sessions are so short, it's not likely to pass. And so these extremists who really wanted permitless carry to pass were getting upset that it wasn't moving faster. And they started to see that it wasn't going to get a hearing and it wasn't going to pass. So some of these extremists, including Chris McNutt, who...
Okay, P.S., that's not a real name. That's not a real person.
You
that's
guys,
not a real name.
We can't make this shit up.
Okay? No. Like, that is freshman screenplay, bad writing. Professor Gunn would turn that away in a heartbeat and say, no, you've got to...
edit that out.
Yeah.
Well, old McNutt, he
had
used,
a gun.
He used to be a staff member for a Republican state senator who was super extreme on gun stuff, Don Huffines. But that senator lost his reelection because he was so extreme. But old McNutt is still in the game, now has paired up with Jonathan Stickland to get this permitless carry bill filed. And he was upset that it wasn't moving faster, and so he decided to employ some pretty intimidating tactics and called up his extremist friends, and they went to the houses of a bunch of Republican legislators that they felt weren't pushing hard enough for this bill to get passed, to sort of give them a piece of their mind. They were wearing pictures of AR-15s on their t-shirts, and these legislators are at the Capitol. It's session. They're not there, so their families are there without them.
What a bunch of, like, dumb bullies. Things aren't going my way. It's not fast enough. I'm just going to show up and, like, bully some people in their homes? It seems so... It's just not normal.
No. Well, and it was very scary, especially to... So we have a new speaker of the Texas House this session, Dennis Bonin, and they were particularly upset with him because he assigned this bill to the Homeland Security Committee, which is chaired by a Democrat who does not like permitless carry. And so they felt that Speaker Bonin wasn't pushing enough, wasn't setting this bill up for success. And so they showed up to his house, and meanwhile, in their sort of own online groups, they were posting pictures of nooses and very intimidating stuff. And so the speaker's wife, who was home with their kids by herself, was scared. And so now, you know, there was a whole kerfuffle in the media, and then the extremists were like, you're lying about this and trying to turn everyone against us. And it's like, no.
Doing that on your own. Huh?
Yeah. But, you know, because our districts here are so gerrymandered, you get these and we've talked about this before, but gerrymandering is just basically drawing a district to be favorable to one party or the other. And because Republicans control how the districts get drawn in Texas for now, it's Republicans that are often very safe. And so they end up getting very extreme people elected because they're only worried about the primaries. They're not worried about beating a Democrat in the general election. So these extremists, because they are in such safe districts, have found these scare tactics to work. And so they continue to use them. But now that...
Until now.
And apparently, a lot of the mainstream, or more historically mainstream Republicans, they really don't like these extremist tactics. And apparently, in our last...
Oh, you're against armed men showing up at people's homes?
Interesting. Okay. Interesting. Just when it happens
to intimidate them? Okay.
Yeah. apparently, two sessions ago, all the House reps started installing panic buttons in their offices at the Capitol because these extremists would show up to their offices and barge in and not leave.
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was all crazy. And then there's like a big, you know, butting of heads between McNutt and Speaker Bonin. But it didn't end there. Apparently, these extremist types still have a lot of support among the Texas Republican Party. And this week, there was their big statewide fundraiser. And this woman who is sympathetic to the gun extremists and pays hundreds of thousands of dollars to the state Republican Party had bought several tables and orchestrated it so that Speaker Bonin was sitting at a table right next to this Chris McNutt cuckoo head guy.
It's like high school. It's like the high school cafeteria or like prom or something.
Yeah. And so we'll link to a Texas Tribune article that kind of captures what happened there. But basically it was setting them up for a confrontation, which happened. And there was some weird stuff that went down.
Something with a Kool-Aid packet?
Yeah.
If anyone understands that reference and reads this Texas Tribune article, please... please message us.
It sounded super weird. We'll link to the article so y'all can read it for yourselves. But eventually, Speaker Bonin left this fundraiser event before he was scheduled to speak at it, and he left before his speaking portion. So, like, something super weird went down.
You know, this kind of reminds me, and I think it's so unfortunate that in a lot of cases, we don't have representatives who can make wise decisions based on data and the experiences of others. They have to let it happen to themselves.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I think, Ash, you rightly pointed out that Speaker Bonin did draw a line in the sand and said, look, you know, permitless carry is not something that I want to have see the light of day, so strategically put it in a place where that wouldn't happen. So in this case, he did not do that with that one particular bill. But if you look at a federal level, you know, the Republicans at a federal level were unwilling to vote to pass the Violence Against Women Act because it had a provision in it that would allow convicted domestic abusers to be disarmed. And that, keep in mind, convicted domestic abusers is less than 1% overall of the domestic abusers that exist in the world.
So, but far more likely to kill their spouse.
Right. Or if you look at every instance of mass murder in this country, invariably there is a correlation to some sort of domestic abuse as well. So it is a huge indicator of other violence towards people in their lives or random acts of violence. You know, it's just so unfortunate that the Republicans at a federal level, it almost makes me feel like they would have to, and I don't want this to happen. You don't want people to be threatened or to have something bad happen to them. But it's like, until something happens to them personally or their families personally, they can't believe this is to be true.
You know, I think that this is a big dividing principle between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. I think Republicans are about me me. And one of the reasons why I'm a Democrat is because we're about helping each other and how we can lift each other up. And I know that's a broad generalization, but like issues like this, I think, yeah, really.
When every data point available says that the more guns are present, the more gun violence will happen, whether it's accidental or self-inflicted towards oneself or towards others, right?
So, well, the issue is we need to be investing in research at the CDC. Like, we should actually be spending money to get more data.
Yeah.
Like, it seems crazy that we don't even do that when it's such an issue in America.
Well, so one good thing that's been going on this session is that there have been more bills introduced this year to improve gun safety in Texas than to loosen gun laws, which is the first time that's ever happened in the Texas legislature.
That's great. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that's really wonderful. But because of all of this weird drama that's going on, some bills that had really broad bipartisan support getting at some of these issues of accidental gun deaths and children getting access to firearms, which is a huge issue, and was something that came to light here in Texas after the Santa Fe shootings, where that kid got a hold of his parents' firearms that weren't stored properly, and that is how he committed those murders. And so there was this bipartisan bill that was voted out of the House committee having to do with the Department of Public Safety doing a statewide public information campaign on safe gun storage and suicide prevention. And it looked like it was going to pass. It had a lot of bipartisan support because it didn't have anything to do with, like, taking our guns away. It was just about safety. But then it stalled in the Senate committee because the NRA came in and put so much pressure on our Texas senators not to let this bill move, which is infuriating.
Yeah.
But lots of positives, lots of good bills being filed, and, you know, more people are paying attention to this issue now, and more people on both sides are willing to give a little bit. But clearly, we have more work to do. We need to elect less extremists to our legislature to really get some movement on these. But, yeah, crazy drama. Thank you so much to Ed Scruggs for giving us all of that context and background about what's going on now.
Go support Texas Gun Sense.
Yes, absolutely.
Go fight the NRA through Texas Gun Sense.
All right, Ash, what's your Mary for the week?
Okay, for this week's Mary, if anyone out there is looking for a wedding venue,
ooh,
have I the place for you.
I'm intrigued.
Yeah. So the DCCC just announced its opening of a new Texas headquarters right here, a new office in Austin.
Oh, it's not even a destination wedding.
Exactly. So the DCCC is the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which is the official campaign arm of the Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives. So they focus on making sure that we keep control of the House and grow our control in the House as well. So the chairwoman of the DCCC, a U.S. rep named Sherry Bustos of Illinois, said that they are expanding their investment in Texas because Texas Democrats proved in 2018 that we can win in competitive districts.
Oh,
heck
yeah.
Yes. And we were all a part of that. And if you feel like you weren't, then now you can join us. It's never too late to join. But y'all, like, holy shit, this is a really big deal.
You know, this. I remember having conversations with people who were volunteering for Beto's Senate campaign. And, you know, the amount that we were able to move the needle here in Texas was a victory in and of itself, even though his campaign was not successful in the traditional sense of winning. But I knew at the time, like, so many more people were turning out. There was a 500% increase in youth voters in Texas. And there was so much attention, you know, coming our way because of what we finally had decided to step up and do.
It feels to me kind of like the parents are finally paying attention to the kids and how running around.
You might get into college after all.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they finally believe in us now because we believe in us.
Yeah.
Finally in Texas. And I think, I mean, it's exciting to see because I think so many people don't vote in Texas because they think that it doesn't matter and their vote's not going to count. Or a lot of people I talk to in Texas say that because they just assume it's a red state. Yeah. which you know we're not.
I read a really interesting poll recently that they polled not people who didn't vote in 2016, and 65% of non-voters in 2016 said they would never vote for Trump. So that is very encouraging and exciting, and we got to talk to all the non-voters starting today.
That's awesome.
Yes.
So the other thing this means is that they're staffing up here in Austin. They're also focusing on six specific U.S. House seats that are flippable because they were lost by fewer than 5 points. So they're also hiring staffers in Dallas and Houston and Austin, and, of course, and also in the San Antonio suburbs. So
polish up your resumes.
Exactly. I don't know anyone at the DCCC, but you should all go apply. And if you do want to, maybe, I don't know, we can help you find someone somehow.
Make all the promises.
Yeah, why not? I don't know. Just message us. Browser TX.
I think,
on social.
You know, if you do apply, you should definitely follow Elwood's advice and make your resume scented for a little something extra.
Why not? So back to these six districts that they are investing in. Trump won in many of these districts, and it's very, like you said, it's also very encouraging to see that many of these districts are now polling with a majority of disapproval for the job that Trump is doing, which is makes sense to me.
Also, really cool to see how many Democrats, how many Democratic presidential candidates have come to Texas or are planning on coming to Texas.
Yes, I'm glad you said that because there's an organization called She the People, and they're a national network focused on elevating the voices and the power, really, of women of color through leadership, political strategists, organizers, and voters. And they're hosting the first ever presidential candidate forum focused on women of color. And they're hosting it here in Texas.
That's awesome.
And you know what? I kind of feel like we're the girl in the movie that had the ponytail and the glasses.
Where she's all that.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And then, like,
it's always every movie.
Exactly. So and then she gets a makeover. But you guys, we were pretty all along.
We were always pretty.
We're exactly she's all that.
You don't need it. Exactly. Yeah. I'm offended by those.
I know.
Like, you just take the glasses off and she gets her braces off or whatever.
Sorry, I didn't mean to derail you.
No, totally. But this event, back to women of color and why we're all so pretty. So She the People is hosting this presidential forum on April 24th in Houston. But listen to who has already RSVP'd. Cory Booker, Julian Castro, Tulsi Gabbard, Amy Klobuchar, Beto O'Rourke, Bernie Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren, all in the same place at the same time in Texas. And it's before, I mean, I don't know how often you get these high caliber presidential candidates in the same place. It's not like the debate stage.
Yeah.
I'm so jealous that you get to go.
I'm pretty excited. I'll be reporting. So if you don't already follow us on social, you should, because I will be taking a lot of selfies that day.
And if you get close to Elizabeth Warren for me, you just take that tiny body and you just jump on her and you interview her.
Wait, if she gives you consent.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if I'm going to jump on
her. I mean, okay. Yeah. But you mean, we already know you're really good with like a folding chair after the whole Jerry Springer situation. So
go back and listen to the first podcast for that reference.
Yeah.
Or maybe the second podcast.
References.
Just listen to them all.
Just listen to them all if you haven't. You're really missing out. We've got great content here. But they're also live streaming the forum. So it has sold out. There's a wait list. So there's still a chance that you could go. But follow them online and they'll be live streaming the whole forum.
Good time to be in Texas.
Yes. Oh, and I wanted to mention specifically the Democratic candidates who have already put their name in the running for these six districts. One of them is Texas 10.
Wait, can you back up real quick? The six districts?
Oh, the six districts that the DCCC has identified that are flippable because...
In the U.S. House.
In the U.S. House, because they only lost by fewer than 5 points in the 2018
Great.
Elections.
Great. Thank you.
So close. We're going to make it happen.
Who are they?
So the first one is Texas 10, and that's my district.
It's my district, too.
Yes.
And we're so far away from each other.
I know. Oh, gerrymandering. So Mike Siegel, who ran in 2018, is definitely running, and also Dr. Pritesh Gandhi. So we'll link all of their info in the show notes so you can check them out. Texas 21.
That's my district.
And... If you listen to our last podcast with Wendy Davis, she mentioned that she's seriously considering running for that seat.
I have Eye of the Tiger playing in my head. I'm like ready to block walk. I can't wait.
Yes. The last ones are Texas 31. I don't think anyone has filed yet, but that was the seat that MJ Hagar ran in last year. So I'm really hoping that she runs
if
she doesn't run
MJ.
For Senate. I know, please. And Texas 23, which is where Gina Ortiz Jones ran last, and I would love nothing more than
a round two fight on
yes,
that.
Yeah, she's such a badass. There's Texas 21. Sarir Kulkarni announced again there, just outside
Wait,
of
20.
Texas. Oh, Texas 22. Yeah, Texas 22.
Guys, Sarir Kulkarni. You guys, if you don't know him, there's this amazing video of him online. Imagine George Clooney, but dreamier, because he speaks like 10 foreign languages. And so there's this amazing video of him online talking to the constituents in his district. And Fort Bend, which is his district, is an extremely diverse district. So there's just this succession of him talking to different potential constituents in all of their foreign languages.
I actually watch it every night before I go to bed, so I'll have sweet dreams.
Yeah. Yeah.
The last one is Texas 24, which Jan McDowell ran in in 2018, and she's running again. And also Kim Olson has announced a run.
Kim Olson for Congress!
Woo! And not to keep plugging ourselves, but I'm going to do it. If you don't know anything about Kim Olson, she was our guest for our first episode.
Because you could take a listen.
I'm one of our fave humans.
Yep. Yep. All right, Ash, that was quite the Mary. And I'm going to bring us back down to Killtown. So, guys, I want to kill the fact that I think I'm going to have to move to Arlington.
Oh, I'll miss you.
I know. I know. It's going to be such a bummer. But somebody has got to run against Tony Tenderholt. If you're not familiar, Tony Tenderholt.
Yet another made-up name.
I know. Like, what? Where do these names come from?
That sounds like a wrestler name. Tony Tenderholt.
Yes. Yes. Can I just give a shout-out to the person who did run against him?
Yeah.
So Finnegan Jones ran against him last fall. He lost by about 8, maybe a little bit over 8 percentage points. So, you know, that's under 10.
Doable.
That's doable. Or Kristen can also try to primary. He hasn't announced that he's running, but I mean, one of y'all should run.
I'll support him.
He was in the Coast Guard and founded a nonprofit to support transgender and gender diverse communities.
No, he's better than me. And I'll make him a good video.
I actually Facebook messaged him to see if he was running again earlier today.
Let's make him run.
Because of Tony Tenderholt.
Okay, but why is Tony so bad?
Okay, so Tony, if you're not familiar, Tony wrote House Bill 896, which is a bill that would criminalize abortion for women and their clinicians.
What do you mean by criminalize?
I'm so glad you asked. So what that means in this instance is that they want to, in Texas state law, redefine murder to include abortion. So therefore, a woman or her clinician, not the man who got her pregnant, could be tried for murder. And in Texas, that would mean they could potentially get the death penalty.
Jeez.
Based on my research, this would actually be the strictest penalization of abortion in the world.
How could you get stricter than the death penalty? Well,
sure. I guess what I mean by that is fair. Like, you know, like burn the ground that you stood on afterwards. I don't know. I did a lot of research on this, and I was actually really surprised. There are a lot of places in the world that abortion is not legal in one form or another. And there are some places in the world where abortion is criminalized. So El Salvador and Chile are two good examples of places where it's criminalized. But even there where it is criminalized, women get time in jail. They are not given the death penalty. So when I
go to live in Texas.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So we'll talk more about Chile and El Salvador in a little bit. So I just want to share a couple of gems from this bill. So this would supersede any executive order or any federal law. So this is saying that it would supersede all of those things. And it also says that they define a human baby as the moment of fertilization. So under this bill, even Plan B would be using Plan B could be tantamount to murder.
Oh my God. Because so Plan B prevents implantation of a
fertilized egg into your the uterine lining. Yeah. Yep.
So I have used it before.
Yeah. No. Me too. Me too.
Murders.
Yeah. Oh,
God.
So some people. There are also under this bill would be no exception for rape or even the life of the mother. So an ectopic pregnancy. you know, that would be something where a woman would either have to die, or the baby would have to die, and she would have to carry it to the point where...
An ectopic pregnancy, for people don't know, is when the fertilized egg implants in the fallopian tube as opposed to in the uterus.
Yeah.
And it's not viable.
It's not a it's completely unviable pregnancy. There's
and
no
could
medical
be very
science.
Dangerous for the woman.
Yep. So in any case, there are 8 authors and co-authors of this bill. It's worth noting that they're all Republicans. They're all men, with the exception of one. We will link in the show notes to all of them, so you can go tell them how you feel about it, if you'd like. It's also worth noting that Tony Tenderholt, the author of this bill, he wrote a similar bill in 2017 that never saw the light of day. It never got a hearing. And at that time in 2017, he's actually quoted as saying, "This law would force women to be more personally responsible with sex." That's a direct quote.
Because, you know, we're just having sex with ourselves. No one else is involved at all.
Right. So this time around, it was referred to the Judiciary and Civil Jurisprudence Committee, which is a mouthful to say. It did get a hearing, which it didn't last time. There were 300 witnesses. There were 466 people that voted in approval of the bill, and there were only 54 against.
That's chilling.
Yeah, I think that really goes to what Wendy Davis said last week, which is versus when she had her big filibuster moment on the floor of the Capitol, and so much attention was being paid, and there were literally there were literally so many women.
Thousands of people showed up.
That they were at max capacity, and that had never happened before in the state of Texas. This time, these bills aren't getting the attention, and this is a great example of that.
And if Wendy Davis is worried, I'm freaking worried.
Yeah. Now, I don't want to bury the lead too much. So the committee chairman is Jeff Leach. He's gone on record as saying that he's not going to let this this bill leave committee. So it won't get a hearing. It won't be.
No, it did get
law.
A hearing.
I mean,
but
sorry,
it won't get voted on.
It won't get voted on.
Well, it includes criminal penalties for women.
Right. So you know, what's really interesting now, we were talking about extremists from gun groups. There are now extremists that are harassing Jeff Leach even today, to the point of having security threats at his office. So
I guess at least they have panic buttons.
Yeah.
You know, I think this was actually in his, you know, I think he's just around the Plano area. I think this was actually his home office up there. Mm. So anyway, that happened. You know, I would say it's not over till it's over, so we can't celebrate yet, but it doesn't look like this will be moving forward. You know, one thing that's worth calling out is Victoria Nieve, who we've talked about on the pod before, had a great quote that was one of the moments that was quoted most in dissent of this bill in the hearing. She said, "How essentially one is okay with subjecting a woman to the death penalty for the exact same thing that one is alleging that she do to a child."
Or fetus or zygote.
Right. Yes. You know, fertilized egg in many cases. Right. Yeah.
Let's talk about Victoria Nieve, though.
We should.
What's going on with Victoria Nieve? I haven't heard.
So she usually is great on this stuff, but there was a pretty bad bill that she voted for. The Born Alive bill.
Ugh.
Which said that if a fetus is aborted and survives the procedure, which is like not a thing that happens in Texas because...
It's not a thing that happens anywhere.
Yeah, but... right. So in Texas, you can't have an abortion past the point of what they call viability, when a fetus would be able to survive outside of the womb. So the chances of a fetus being aborted and being able to survive the procedure, like, it just doesn't happen. So it's just one of these bills. It's a messaging bill, right? It's a misinformation and fire up the base kind of bill. And it's, I don't understand why she voted for it. It's very odd.
Yeah.
But we'll have to ask. We can reach out.
If you live in her district, she's based in Dallas. You might want to give her a call.
Send a note. Ask what's up there.
And, you know, we love her. She's on the right side of so many things and has made so many great bills. you know, be curious to know what was going on there with that one. But actually, to bring it back to what you were saying, I was doing my research on this bill, I did some research on statistics for late term abortions, and there has never been a documented case of a quote unquote born alive abortion in Texas.
Right. Yeah, so, it's not a thing.
Yeah, it's not a thing that happens.
Okay, can we rewind? I'm curious about this whole Chile, El Salvador. You kind of like teased it at the top of this. What is up?
Totally.
What's going on there?
So we'll link to it in the show notes. There's actually a map that it's an interactive map online that shows you everywhere in the world the abortion policies that they have. You know, what's legal, what's not legal. The criminalization levels, that sort of thing.
It's scary to think that we are so backwards on a lot of this.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, it's surprising as a developed country that you...
Yeah.
I shouldn't be surprised. Nothing should surprise me anymore.
Well, you know, in doing some more research, you know, and I talked about this up top a little bit with El Salvador and Chile. You know, one of the things in digging deeper on that, they do have right now some of the harshest criminalization penalties in the world. There are 17 women that are sitting in jail right now in El Salvador, for example, for purportedly having abortions. Now, in those cases, from what I've read, and it shouldn't matter. It shouldn't matter. But from what I've read in these cases, the women did not know they were pregnant. They started bleeding. They went to the hospital, and they were in the process of having miscarriages. Now, from a clinical perspective, there's no blood test that shows you, oh, you've had an abortion versus you were having a miscarriage.
You know what they call in the medical community a miscarriage? An abortion.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. It's like medical terminology.
Because that's just...
They don't say miscarriage.
Because an abortion is a medical... procedure.
Right. And it also is something that your body can do naturally on its own with assistance.
And unfortunately, these women are sitting in jail. Again, if they had had an abortion, that, you know, they should have autonomy over their body. So I don't want to shame anyone, or I don't want to be confused for shaming anyone for having an abortion. But you have women who are sitting in prison in earnest who have said, I had a miscarriage, went for medical treatment, and am now sitting in jail for murder. And so when we look at people like our legislators playing with fire, saying that we should be charging women with murder and potentially giving them the death penalty for something that could be confused with a miscarriage, which at least, you know, one quarter, if not more, of first pregnancies end in a miscarriage, that's haunting to me. And it's haunting to me for even more personal reasons. I have had a miscarriage. I had a miscarriage in a very startling and shocking way. I was driving down the highway with my husband, and I started having what at the time felt like very strong period cramps. After having children later on in life, I realized that they were contractions. We pulled over at a bar/gas station, and I had a miscarriage in a bar bathroom. To know that if I had needed to seek medical attention, or if someone had walked in on me, that I could have been charged with murder is horrifying.
I'm sorry that that happened to you.
Thank you. You know, it's you very generously shared about your miscarriage story in the past, Becky, and I, you know, for me it was a little bit different. It wasn't something that felt like a loss, because it was very early on, and, you know, I was still very young, and it was something that was, quite frankly, being pregnant was frightening. So, you know, it was something that, you know, I had a different experience than you did, but it was very traumatic. It was exceptionally traumatic. And so in knowing that if you had had the added level of fear of criminalization added to that, God help the women that could happen to in the future in our state. And I mean, honestly, like, it is baffling to me the recklessness with which these men are making these bills that they have no understanding over.
Yeah. And, you know, just going back to, like, both of us have had miscarriages, and we both experienced them very differently.
because mine, I had been trying, I had had to go through like fertility meds and stuff to get pregnant. I had been trying so long and so hard to get pregnant. So when I lost it, it was very devastating to me. But it just goes to show that the way that we build our families and the way that we experience that is so personal. And to have legislators who have no idea what our lives are come in and try and dictate across the board for the infinite number of ways that we choose.
Right.
And sometimes choose don't choose. Have a family. Or yeah. don't choose.
We just want to have sex because it's fun.
Yes. Like,
or just the way that the ways that our bodies create life.
Yeah.
Right? Like that's like, you know.
It's infinite the number of ways that that can go.
Yeah.
So it just goes to show that like there can't be blanket prescriptions for how to do this and how to treat it and what is right and wrong. Like, it's ridiculous.
Why people should have choice for their own bodies.
So bringing it back to some positive stuff, Ash, you were doing some serious advocating today.
Oh, yes, I was. So after we heard from Wendy and how worried she was, I was like, oh, shit, I should probably do something. So I registered to lobby with Planned Parenthood for their Texas Lobby Day, which I just came from. And I was also asked by a woman named Erica Nix, who, if you live in Austin, you need to go find her and work out with her. She is like the love child of Richard Simmons and a unicorn.
Accurate.
Who is always clad in like amazing 80s workout attire. And I'll link her classes in the show notes. You can come dance it out with me on a Tuesday night. But she organized a group of dancers to do a little like cute surprise ditty in front of the Planned Parenthood activists just to pump them up while they're eating lunch on the South Lawn in front of the Capitol today. And we were...
Let me just say, because I got there a little late and I caught just the very tail end of your performance, but what I showed up in time to see was something even better.
What
which
happened?
Was a guy from InfoWars was there with
like
a megaphone.
The guy?
No, not no. Alex Jones.
Okay. It was just another guy, but he was shouting. So this happened before we started doing our little dance.
Jesus.
And he came over and he was harassing the activists. So the activists are literally, if you imagine them, it's a bunch of amazing people wearing hot pink Planned Parenthood t-shirts. And then you've got they're all around tables eating their lunch on the lawn, just like very quietly. There was nothing going on.
Yeah, like polite.
Just polite. They're just eating their boss lunch.
Yeah.
And then you have this like group of weirdos in the corner who were all wearing, like I was wearing a hot pink leotard. Everyone's wearing their spandex. And then the InfoWorks guy shows up and he's yelling out of his megaphone like, abortion is murder. Y'all, like, you are murderers, and like harassing these people who are just quietly.
Your tone is surprised, but like, I'm not surprised that some.
But here's what I showed up to witness that was amazing. So, first, I hear megaphone guy, and then I hear Erica Nix's boombox blaring this song that was like, Mind Your Business or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, so we were dancing to a song that's called Mind Your Own Business by Delta 5. I'll also link that song in the show notes because it ended up kind of like becoming our anthem. So we did our little dance and then she basically was chasing him down with the boombox so that we could drown out his slurs and his shouting with like this.
So there's all these women in hot pink leotards dancing around him. And I showed up and I was just like, this is the best way to meet aggression and negativity is with like this joyous, yeah, hilarious.
With spandex and dancing.
It was so just so perfect.
And we literally ran in circles behind him and in front of him for, it felt like it was like 20 minutes. I don't know how long this went on for, but the song just kept replaying again and again. And there was actually this moment where he stood in front of this woman and started yelling slurs at her and calling her a man, asking her if she was a man. And it was disgusting. And it was this, I mean, the whole thing was a little bit silly, but it was this incredibly empowering moment to see my friends stand in between them and to be that wall of like, you shouldn't have to deal with this. I am the one carrying a boombox, so I'm gonna. we'll post the video.
It was amazing.
It was a very weird moment, and I may or may not be making news tonight wearing a pink
pink leotard.
Like, can I see you on the Daily Show in a segment where... Well, I'm really proud of you. That's awesome.
It was, yeah, it was a great day.
Standing up to some bullies with 80s music and spandex. There's nothing better than that.
It's the way to do it. And yeah. Lobbying, there was, I met a lot of people who, one specific woman, her name is Corinne. I hope she's okay that I just said that. And she, it was her first time ever at the Capitol. And she was there lobbying. And I thought that was just amazing. And so many people like me who didn't have a lot of experience lobbying who were just going for it. So it was really empowering and refreshing to be a part of.
Well, thank you so much for doing that and your advocacy with that. That's
creative advocacy in spandex. Yeah. So good.
Yeah.
Best kind.
Well, we'll just end it there. This has been the longest fuck, marry, kill on record. Notify Guinness Book of World Records. If you guys have a fuck, marry, kill for the week, please share it with us online at RouserTX.
All right, Becky, what do you know?
So for this week's Did Y'all Know, we did an interview with Jody Casey, who was Beto's campaign manager in his 2018 Senate campaign. And I was so excited to get a chance to talk to her. It was actually a couple weeks ago that we spoke with her. It was just before Beto had his big presidential campaign kickoff where he did a bunch of different rallies, but one of them was in Austin. So it was before that we talked to her. So just for context, when you hear the interview, it was a couple weeks ago. But one of the reasons that I really wanted to speak with her is because historically, and even now, there is a real lack of female campaign staffers at the highest levels, even in the Democratic Party. So if you don't know what a campaign manager does, which is what Jody did for Beto's Senate campaign, it's basically like a campaign is kind of like a mini business that starts up quickly and runs its course and then is done. And the campaign manager is kind of like the CEO of that business. They are in charge of lots of strategy for the campaign. They're kind of like running all the things to give advice to the candidate. They kind of like are their handler a little bit. They run interference. They kind of set priorities. They do a lot. And so I was really impressed knowing that so few women get these campaign manager roles at high levels, especially on male campaigns. I was very impressed that Jody got that job. And also knowing that she didn't have a lot of political experience herself. She was coming from the corporate world into that role. So I really wanted to talk to her about that and sort of the facts around that, the stats, to just so you guys know how rare it has been typically for a woman to have that role. In 2018, 40% of the campaign managers for Democratic congressional candidates were women, which is pretty great. And actually, 8 years before that, the number was so low that it wasn't even counted. So,
what?
Yeah. Oh, so, like, wow. There was a huge increase in the number of female campaign managers, but it's really only on the Democratic side that increase was happening, and that's because there were three times as many Democratic women on the ballot compared with Republican women on the ballot. But I think it's interesting that typically it's a female candidate who's hiring female staff at those levels. So that's just another reason why Jody, she was in a pretty rare position to be a female campaign manager for a male candidate at such a high level. So it was really interesting to get to talk to her, and I'm excited to share that interview with y'all. Mm. Joining me today, I'm so pleased to welcome Jody Casey, who was Beto O'Rourke's campaign manager for his 2018 Senate run. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jody.
No problem. I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, I'm really excited to share sort of your story with folks because we're always interested in people like ourselves who didn't ever envision themselves getting involved in politics. And then you jumped in a really big way. So like I mentioned, you were his campaign manager when he was running to represent Texas in the U.S. Senate in 2018. And of course, now Beto is running for president. Do you have an official role on his presidential campaign?
I do. I am on his board of directors of his presidential campaign. It's an unpaid position, but it has some financial oversight of the campaign. And then obviously I am going to be a volunteer for him as well.
Awesome. Cool. Well, I'm sure that he'll be glad to have your institutional knowledge after all the blood, sweat, and tears you put into his Senate campaign. So I mentioned before that I know you didn't have any serious political experience before you stepped into running Beto's campaign for Senate. Can you tell me what were you doing before you got involved with his campaign and the story of how you came to be his campaign manager?
Sure. So I worked for General Electric for 18 years. I went to them straight out of college, and I was always in sales roles or sales executive roles in the energy and healthcare industries within GE. And once I moved to El Paso in 2005, I started to get involved behind the scenes in local politics because El Paso really was behind the times. Our downtown was really antiquated and there wasn't a lot to do when we moved here. My husband's from here. And so I wanted to make it a city where we really wanted to live and raise kids in. And so I started to work behind the scenes and supporting local politicians who were forward thinking and wanted to progress El Paso. And that's how I met Beto. He was on city council, and he and his wife Amy got married just a week apart from my husband and I. So we kind of were on the same timeline in terms of like having kids, raising kids, and caring about El Paso moving forward. So I started getting involved in, just kind of hosting fundraisers, doing things like that, block walking for candidates in El Paso who I felt like would be great for the city.
That's awesome. And I can say, as somebody who has visited El Paso a couple times over the last year, I really can see the difference that that effort made in the downtown area. It's really an amazing revitalization that's taking place there. And I'm like, maybe should I move to El Paso? It's like pretty cool.
It's a lot cheaper than Austin, too. It's a great place to live. We just didn't have many amenities when I first moved here. And now we have a AAA baseball park. That's a world-class stadium. It's amazing. And there's things like we have the trolleys now, so we can walk down the street from where we live, jump on a trolley and head downtown and do really fun things. We have a digital wall, and it's just become a really great place to live. It's been so fun to be part of that transformation, and politics played such a huge, piece of that as well.
That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, you can really see what happens when people who live in a community and want to see it bettered get involved and make real change. So that's awesome. And so I know that if I remember hearing this story before, Beto came to you when he decided to run for Senate and asked you to be his campaign manager. And what did you say?
That's correct. And I said no. I had been part of kind of like his kitchen counter crew of close friends and advisors who kind of knew probably really in November or December of 2016, right after Trump was elected, that he was going to run. And so, we were kind of advisors to him, and we threw multiple fundraisers for him, getting him prepared for the announcement. And then after the announcement as well, I've thrown a huge fundraiser for him. And he had said to Amy, like, I just need someone like Jody who has good judgment. I don't need the political experience. I just want someone who I can trust and has good judgment. So he called and asked me and kind of told me that. And I just said, that's crazy. I can't run a Senate campaign. He goes, was there a chance? And I said, well, maybe like 4%. Like, why that number? I go, I don't know. But it took me about a week of talking to my husband and the kids and kind of like walking through the decision where we just decided I had to do it. We felt like every day we would wake up and assess like the damage that Trump was doing to our country and really the world. And we just felt like this is the right thing to do. It was our moral obligation. So I decided to jump in.
Well, I think that's really amazing. And it makes me curious, what got you from 4% to 100% to say yes?
Well, I talked to a couple of mentors. First of all, I think the idea was really shocking to me, right? So I'm like, no, that's crazy, no. And then after a few days of thinking it through, kind of understanding what I'd need to do put financially, to put my career on hold, and how it would affect my family. After I thought through those things, the choice became very clear. I think at first I was just surprised. So luckily I had some good mentors and a coach that helped me walk through that decision-making process. But it only took me a week to get there, so that's good.
Yeah, that's awesome. And one thing I've heard people who worked on Beto's campaign say is that they prioritized hiring people who really believed in the campaign and who really believed in Beto over people, you know, who had the political credentials instead, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's true. And some of that was because we had agreed not to hire consultants. And so most people that had been in politics for a long time or had a certain, like, very specific political skill set really would only come on campaigns as consultants. And so, you know, because of that, the nature, we ended up with, like, just people who were just really excited about Beto and really committed to him and the cause, which was great. It was awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I think it showed, you know, the enthusiasm. You can tell when enthusiasm is genuine for a campaign. And I think that really came through, and it was contagious. So I met you just after the premiere of the Running with Beto documentary, which will be coming to HBO in May, I believe. And I remember hearing you talk about parts of the film that were particularly emotional for you to watch. And those were the scenes where Beto's kids were clearly missing him while he was out on the campaign trail. I think it was hard for anybody who was a parent to watch, but it was hard for you because you're close with him and his kids, but it also you have your own kids that you were trying to navigate parenting while on the campaign trail. Can you tell us, how old are your kiddos?
Sure. They are 7 and 8, and they go to school with Beto and Amy's kids. So we see each other often.
That's awesome. And so I think that most people who are considering getting involved in politics and have children, the first thing that comes to their mind is how difficult that will be. Politics is not known for being kind to parents of young children. But is there anything that your family and your kids in particular gained from you being so involved in this historic campaign here in Texas?
I sure hope so. I mean, I had for a while a ton of guilt about just not being there for them for 18 months. And I think it was especially hard on my husband too, because he also works full time and then was really the primary caregiver for 18 months of the kids. And so, but I look back on the experience although I sometimes have a little guilt about it, I do think it's made them much more well-rounded children. So one good sign, I think, is that Beto is announcing officially his presidency Saturday morning here in El Paso. And we asked the boys if they wanted to come or if they wanted to go to their Little League baseball kickoff and parade. And they chose Beto's announcement. Aww. So we were really excited about that. And
they're not harboring some resentment toward him.
I know. I was like, there's no way they're going to choose his announcement. They're so tired of going to his events. But that was not their choice. They both said, we are going to go with you. It's more important to us than baseball. And so I think it's made them, like, have an awareness of how important politics is for, like, our well-being and for other people's well-being. And they also have been able to see, for example, like, a lot of the asylum seekers who just get dumped in, like, random bus stations and then picked up by these amazing nonprofits in El Paso. And they've donated toys. And so they can connect the dots between, you know, the people that Beto talks about and the stories that he weaves through in his narratives and his speeches. They've actually seen it themselves. So it's been really good for them to make that connection.
That's amazing. And, you know, a lot of us who don't live near the border, we have to rely on what we hear in the media or on social media about what's happening there. And so it's really powerful, I think, that your kids are able to see firsthand the results of policy.
Absolutely. I think they're lucky. So, I mean, it was hard and I was very emotional watching the documentary because I felt bad for Molly, Ulysses, and Henry, but I also, you know, feel bad for my kids as well.
Yeah.
I wasn't gone as much. But even when I was here with them, I wasn't here.
Yes.
if that makes sense.
I'm often there and not there with my kids, and
yeah,
it's hard.
And sometimes that could be harder too.
Yeah,
yeah,
I agree. Well, on the topic of parents of young kids being involved in politics, which is something I feel passionately about because I think our voice and our perspective is so important, but there are some pretty significant barriers for us to be involved in the process because we're raising young children. From your experience and, you know, sort of being newer to the political arena, is there anything you think progressives in the political space can do to make it easier for parents of young kids to get involved?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I didn't have really any female mentors that had done a race this big recently. Like someone mentioned a race like, oh, she should have called so-and-so. And I'm like, that was 20 years ago when she ran, you know, when she was the campaign manager. So I didn't have a lot of mentors. And I had one woman that I knew, and she said to me, she's like, oh, you can't do this with two small kids. So I think like just coming from the premise that it can be done, which you saw because we did it. I think that's important. Beto has now hired a new campaign manager for his presidential race. She also is a mom of small children. And so I think that's really exciting that he's doing that twice in a row. I mean, he's one of the most interesting and probably, I think, one of the best politicians of our generation. And here he is twice in a row hiring two working moms, right? And so I think, like, it's going to help a lot of people be interested in getting more involved because they can see that I did it and that Jennifer's going to do it.
Well, I'm certainly inspired. And like you say, you know, a lot of people just say right out of the gate, oh, you can't do it. But you and others are proving that wrong. And I think the more of us who do get involved, the more mentors there will be, right? Like you were saying that it was hard for you to find a mentor, but now you can mentor someone. I think that's awesome.
Absolutely. And that's definitely something I want to do. And I think for me, the key was having a spouse who was willing to take on like really the burden of raising the kids. Not that it's a burden, but like it is so much work, as you know.
Absolutely.
And so he did every sporting event. He did every piece of homework with them and every pickup and drop off for really 18 months. And so like having that kind of commitment and somebody who's willing to do that is truly amazing. And so I would say that's the only way that I could have done it.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I know for me, it gives me real reverence for single parents, for sure.
For sure. It's such a hard job and it's the most important job raising these kids. But I'm just thankful that he allowed for me to do it. And that's why it was such a family decision. And I think that's why Beto speaks that language as well when he talks about running for president or having run for Senate, is that he and Amy and the kids made the decision together. We had to do the same thing because it was really, it's such a big commitment on everyone's part.
Yeah, totally.
In the family.
So you talked about, you know, Beto and the way that he's been making his decisions and he, since he's announced for president, has gotten a lot of press coverage nationally. Is there anything that you think the national media is getting wrong when they talk about him?
I think there's a lot they're getting wrong. But I have a pretty thick skin when it comes to like negative press, because I know him so well, and we've been through this before in the congressional race and then again in the Senate race. I don't appreciate anything negative said about Amy, his wife. She's just amazing. I'm not sure if you got a chance to meet her.
Did you
all get a chance to meet her?
I did, yes.
Yeah, and she is such a strong woman. She's also a working mom, which I think people tend to forget in these kind of like narratives that they have about Beto and Amy. And she's just shy. And so she's not someone that wants to be talking on camera all the time. And so I think the things that upset me the most are when Amy's mischaracterized because she's such a wonderful human being, an amazing mother, an amazing partner to Beto, and a terrific mom and working mom.
Yeah, you know, I noticed, so in his announcement video, I saw some people online, you know, kind of taking a jab at the fact that she didn't say anything in that announcement video. And after having met her, the same premiere that I met you, and I actually asked her if she would be a guest on the podcast, and she got really uncomfortable, and she was like, oh, I'm so nervous, you know, being on camera or talking in front of people. And so I could see, you know, from just having met her briefly, that that's all that was. But of course, you know, when you're in the spotlight, people make up their own narratives.
Absolutely. And she's so great. She's just shy and she's not naturally comfortable speaking to people or to the camera. And I understand that. And I appreciate that about her.
Well, and it makes sense that sorry. Keep going.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, we tend to find the partner who compliments us. So it would make sense that somebody as comfortable speaking in front of people as Beto would find someone, you know, who's a little more reserved.
Absolutely. And they're such a great team. So, I mean, they're a perfect complement to each other.
Well, I really appreciate you spending some time with us today and telling us more about your story and what's next for you.
Well, I have a full-time job now. So I'm doing some work with a company called Elego. They're a startup out of Austin, actually. And they allow for doctors to do clinical research in underserved markets like El Paso. So I got connected to them right after the election, and I'm really enjoying my work with them. And then, of course, I can't not help behind the scenes with the Beto campaign. And then there are other small campaigns of people that we met along the way, along the campaign trail during the Senate race, who I've been helping as a volunteer. So I'm going to continue to be an activist and a volunteer. And I started a Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense chapter here in El Paso. We
Awesome.
Had one before, and Beto kicked off our first meeting, and I met so many moms and survivors who have become friends now. And so it was a natural progression for me to start that chapter. And, you know, common sense gun laws are one of the reasons why I was willing to jump in and help Beto in the Senate race. So I'm thrilled to be hosting that chapter here.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for all the work that you did on the campaign and all the work that you're continuing to do to make Texas better and then to mentor others who will be coming along after you. I think that's fantastic. And I thank you so much, Jody.
Oh, thanks. This was such a nice conversation. I appreciate it.
Oh, well, hopefully we'll talk to you again sometime.
Sounds great. Take care.
You too. Bye. Ashley, tell me. What is the shit to do this week?
So there is a piece of shit bill up in the Texas Senate. Well, there's many. But the one we're focusing on this week is called SB9, which is an extremely dangerous attack on voting rights. It would criminalize simple mistakes in the registration and voting process.
I'm screwed. You know how I spelled your last name?
Yeah. Plus, it gives state lawmakers like Indict Attorney General Ken Paxton access to the voter rolls where he could further threaten and intimidate voters, which Republicans love to do.
Well, and also, it does some really mean stuff. Like, it makes it a crime to help somebody, like, drive them to the polls.
Yeah, the three of us could drive together, but if we had a fourth person in the car, that's against the law.
It's a good thing we don't have a fourth friend. We can still go vote together. It's crazy. It puts at risk and creates voter intimidation among specific populations like disabled Texans, like that helping someone vote
right.
situation, elderly voters, same situation, and communities of color. And I became a VDR, or a volunteer deputy registrar, to register voters in Travis County. And by the way, if you are a VDR, your certification expires at the beginning of every odd number year.
Because we just can't make it easy.
Right? And like, it's just, exactly. So get out there and renew if you haven't already.
I need to renew mine.
I also do. So we should, we'll make a party. Anyway, I registered my mom in 2018, and it was the first time. She's lived in America since 1977, and I registered her to vote for her first time in 2018.
Aww.
And honestly, like, she was so hesitant and uncomfortable and scared, even by the process of registering. Well, that process was a little bit more like she didn't really feel like she had the right to vote because she felt like she didn't know enough.
Oh, my gosh. So I've experienced that myself.
Well, and she's some makes me weepy. She's like constantly thinks that she doesn't know enough because she doesn't speak the language as well.
Aww.
And it's constantly downplaying her own
education. Which I think that's really common in a lot of immigrant communities. And honestly, when I took her to vote for her first time, it was in the primary in 2018, and she had a vote with a provisional ballot because they said that she wasn't registered. And I hand-delivered her registration myself to the office.
What?
We never figured out what the issue was, but we got her registered that day. And I went to vote with her again, and when we voted together in the fall, like, by that point, she was like, that was a terrible experience. They made her feel stupid. And it just the idea that they're trying to make it seem even more complicated and intimidating for people like my mother and for so many other Texans, it's just atrocious. But there's still time, hopefully, to do something about this. They've been delaying and delaying the vote in the Texas Senate. So it's incredibly urgent that you take action immediately, because by the time you listen to this, they may have already voted on it. But I talked to Senator Kirk Watson. He's my Texas senator. I talked to his office today, and they said that they aren't technically supposed to be in session on Fridays yet in the ledge. So we might have made it. But you just never know when Dan Patrick is going to call a bill to the floor. So if you've already been speaking about this bill with organizations like the Texas Civil Rights Project or Progress Texas or Common Cause or Move Texas, Texas Rising, many of our favorites, then know that your calls are working because they keep delaying it. And that is a good thing. We'll link to a petition that you can sign from Progress Texas and Common Cause if you want a really easy way just to show your that you're against, an easy way to fight this bill. But if you want to call your senator, you can text SB9 to 97779, and Texas Rising, which is a fantastic youth-led organization in Texas, they'll connect you to your state senator, and we'll give you lots of info in the show notes.
And all you have to say, so for people who are not used to calling their representatives, you don't have to go on and on. You can just call and say, I would like for you to vote against this bill or not support this bill. And, like, that's all you have to say. And they count that in the against column. Like, you don't have to go on and on.
But you can if you want to, and especially if you have a Republican rep, then you should
if you
take
to.
Up a lot of their time if you feel like it.
I just don't want it to stop people if they feel like they don't, you know, have the right language.
And also, I'm a big proponent of ResistBot because I hate calling people. So we'll link to that, too. If you don't know what I'm talking about, we'll link to it. Super easy. You can text them, and then it faxes them. Flood the fax machines.
It's wild that we still even have fax machines.
I know, right?
That's a whole other
The Congress... They're, you know, the government has fax machines. Nobody else does. All right. That's it for the show this week, guys. Thanks for listening. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast if you don't already. Give us a 5-star review. Do all of the shit. Follow us on all of the socials at RouserTX. See you next week.
Bye.
Hear you next week. No, you'll hear us next week. That's it.
Maybe we'll see you live.
Yes. Come
see us. At the Awesome Dems party.
Yes.
Yeah, we'll link to that as well, because we really want to meet our fan.
You should just stop talking.
Yeah, right now.